Good morning. Court's ready to hear argument. Are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Very well. Good morning, Mr. Connors.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honors, my name is Kevin Connors, and I represent the appellant in this case. The full name of the appellant is the Delaware Community Corporation for Individual Dignity, known by its moniker DelSit, and that's how I'll refer to it. DelSit was basically an organization that contracted with the state to provide staffing services for group homes and residents of that sort for folks who are mentally disabled. And it was in the context of this contract that this claim arose. We had a seven-day trial, which ended in November of 2003, and the verdict was $150,000 in compensatory damages and $1,440,000 in punitive damages rendered against my client, DelSit, and against its former employee, Leonard Conyers, who is now in jail serving a 12-year sentence for the crimes that he committed. The apportionment of negligence against my client was 40%. The apportionment of negligence against Mr. Conyers was 60%. But the apportionment of recklessness was only 10% for Mr. Conyers and 90% for my client. Mr. Conyers had never filed an answer to the complaint in this case, so a default judgment was taken by the plaintiffs against him. The jury was essentially simply asked to apportion. He was deemed negligent and reckless, and the jury was asked to apportion negligence and recklessness as to Mr. Conyers, who was not represented at the trial, although he did testify. Before a trial, the 1983 claim that plaintiffs brought was dismissed. The vicarious liability claim against my client was dismissed on motion, and the claim of negligent and reckless hiring was also precluded by the trial court on a Daubert motion, which I filed on behalf of my client. I also filed a motion, that same motion under Daubert, asked the court to preclude plaintiff's expert, Mr. Summerson, from testifying that my client was negligent in its supervision. Although the court granted the motion, the court found that expert testimony was not necessary on the negligent supervision claim, and that claim was the one that preceded the trial, along with the claim of negligent and reckless failure to prevent the abuse of Mr. Jones. Your Honors, we have submitted five arguments in our brief, and I'd like to dwell more on certain of those arguments than other of those arguments. Our first argument is that the trial court erred in denying DelSit's motion for judgment NOV because the evidence actually warranted judgment of NOV in our favor. I have set forth from page 7 through 16 of the opening brief a synopsis of the testimony which my client believes warrants a finding of judgment notwithstanding the verdict. Certainly, on the claim of negligent supervision is essentially a claim against the supervisor, who was a fellow named Jeffrey Rose. And
is he the only one?
He was essentially the only one, Your Honor. That was the only evidence that basically came out at trial was evidence against Mr. Rose, who did testify.
Well, your client's a corporation. How would you allege negligent supervision against the corporation if you didn't focus on the conduct of an individual employed by the corporation?
I agree that that's how you would do it, Your Honor. But our argument is that the evidence that was presented against Mr. Rose, and therefore as to the corporation, was simply insufficient as a matter of law to warrant a jury verdict of negligence or recklessness.
I have a problem with that because the two briefs seem to be disputing the fact. That is, your argument is that there's not sufficient evidence. The other side says the record has abundant evidence to show that the people who were supervising or responsible for supervising Mr. Conyers knew that something was afoot and yet did nothing about it.
Well, Your Honor, on that point, Mr. Rose, there was no evidence that Mr. Rose ever knew that anything was afoot. The only individual who knew that something might be afoot, and I use the word might carefully because I think it's important in this case, Sally Olembo, whose testimony is summarized, basically would review what are called ID notes, which are basically notes that detail what happens in a given day for any particular individual, such as Mr. Jones. And she found, with respect to an ID note on August 22, 1999, that Mr. Jones had been taken out to Delaware Park by Mr. Conyers and returned late in the evening. In fact, early.
Is this the same ID note that references the fact that the victim left his wallet at the motel?
No, Your Honor. That is the next ID note, which is dated August 31st of 1999. That is what I've called the wallet in the hotel ID note. And in August, in late August, August 22nd of 1999, based upon this ID note, that's when Ms. Olembo began to have suspicions that something might be afoot. But she had a suspicion.
Excuse me. We've all read the briefs, and I think we have a running start on the facts. But it would be helpful today if we focused on the law. And my question is, are you saying that as a matter of law, unless Mr. Rose knew something, your client could not be liable? Irrespective of what anybody else knew, and if Mr. Rose didn't know it, your client couldn't be held liable?
I am, Your Honor, because the only individual who really had a supervisory role over Mr. Conyers at this point in time was Mr. Rose. And
is there any legal authority for that position that in a corporation that employs many people, if several individuals have information which, if true, a trier of fact could say would lead to negligence as a matter of law, unless one person who's the ultimate supervisor knew that information, the corporation's not liable?
You know, I think basically Ms. Olembo was, you know, quote-unquote, a lower level employee who only had a suspicion, and if her conduct was guided by PM 46, which is a regulation promulgated by the DMR, you need, you know, reasonable cause to come forward. And at that point in time, all she had was a suspicion. And just 2 weeks after that ID note about the wallet in the hotel, just 2 weeks after, there were questions brought to bear with respect to what Mr. Conyers was doing, if anything, with Mr. Jones, by the folks in my client.
Well,
I think that their conduct
after the ID note was found about the hotel incident, it was at that point, was it not, that Olembo questioned the victim, Mr. Jones.
Relatively, I think within a week of that, Your Honor.
And didn't get any answer.
That is true.
Now, at that point, wasn't it incumbent upon her to go to her supervisor?
I know of no law or case law that requires her to do so, Your Honors. Basically, I think my client had to be guided. The employees to whom this PM 46 was disseminated had to guide their own conduct by that. You needed reasonable cause.
If she was obligated, or if a jury could have found that she should have brought all of these facts to the attention of Mr. Rose at that point, then would the outcome of the case be different? That is,
the
would the decision be different?
The lawsuit would still have been filed because all this conduct occurred beforehand, and that's probably another one of my, is one of my other points, Your Honors, and that is we had no factual reason to believe, nor any foreseeable reason to believe that Mr. Conyers was doing these things with Mr. Jones up until about 2 or 3 weeks before all of this actually came to light by way of an investigation.
Suppose Ms. Olimbo, in the initial interview or discussion with Mr. Jones, learned all the facts about what was going on, but didn't tell Mr. Rose. Is it your position that the fact that she didn't tell Mr. Rose precludes liability on the part of the corporation?
No, Your Honor, that's not the position.
That couldn't be the law.
Right.
And therefore, Ms. Olimbo knew would at some point be attributed, would it not, to the corporation?
I think after August 31st, which is when I think you have, that's the second ID note, Your Honor. That's the wallet in the hotel note. The first ID note of August 22nd, 1999, really simply states that Mr. Conyers was out with Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones is allowed to be out. He was his own guardian.
And this conduct took place for more than 18 months, is that correct?
It did, Your Honor. It did.
So if we look at this from a jury's perspective, your position seems to be, although Mr. Jones was sexually assaulted repeatedly over the course of 18 months, there's no way your client could have known about that. And a reasonable jury might have thought, perhaps you shouldn't have a system in place where someone can get assaulted sexually, criminally, for 18 months and not know about it.
Well, Your Honor, in point of fact, we did have a system in place. There was evidence that Mr. Rose met with Mr. Conyers on a regular basis and talked about his interactions with the clients that he supervised. Mr. Jones was a quote-unquote higher functioning, mentally challenged individual.
Well, I understand that, you know, we're trying to respond to your legal arguments that as a matter of law, the Superior Court should have taken this away from the jury and entered judgment in your favor. And my question is, isn't a fact for the jury to decide raised by a situation which indicates for 18 months someone was criminally assaulted sexually and nobody knew about it?
Well, my position, Your Honor, is that the judge should have taken the case away simply because this happened over 18 months, granted, Your Honor, but the instances that we know of were three. And they are detailed in the complaint. But Mr. Conyers, you know, was able to conceal these instances from his supervisor, and there was really no way for us to...
But not other members of your employees of your client. Other people knew things along the way, and isn't that imputed to your client?
Well, yeah, there's no evidence, Your Honor, as far as I remember from the record, that any other folks in Delsa's organization knew that this was going on.
Well, who testified that they were concerned about stains on Mr. Jones's clothes?
I believe that was Ms. Olimbo.
Mm-hmm.
But Your Honor, but she also, her testimony was that she attributed that to the fact that those kinds of things happen with mentally challenged individuals. This could have been a self-made situation, so to speak, Your Honor.
Is it your view that the only evidence upon which your client was found culpable was the absence of a system in which this wrongdoing could have been uncovered much earlier?
I believe so, Your Honor, because there was no evidence presented by the plaintiffs at trial of what type of system should have been in place.
Well, I'm just answer my question. Is that the case on which your client was the recipient of a damage award?
I believe that to be the case, Your Honor, only because I don't know on what basis the jury found my client negligent, because we argued to the trial court that there should have been an expert who
Is the answer yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And was the jury instructed on the claim of failure to have in place an adequate system?
No, Your Honor.
It was not?
No, Your Honor.
Well, what was the argument to the jury?
The argument to the jury was that Mr. Rose, as Mr. Conyers' supervisor, should have known that this was going on. That was the only real argument that was raised.
Should have known.
Should have known, because it occurred over 18 months.
Should have known because he was asleep at the switch, or should have known because Ms. Olimbo knew a lot earlier and didn't tell him?
I think it was mostly that he was asleep at the switch, although his testimony belied that fact.
You said you had five arguments. You wanted to emphasize a few of them. I think we spent a lot of time on the first one.
Okay, Your Honor, thank you. However, on that first argument, Your Honor, this dovetails with my last argument. The trial court allowed plaintiff's negligent supervision claim, which I believe subsumes, logically, plaintiff's claim of negligent failure to prevent abuse, because it basically assumes that you know about something or you have in place some system for that.
Or should.
To prevent that, or should have. I had contended that the plaintiff required an expert on the claim of negligent supervision. The judge said, no, that's not the case. The jury can figure this out themselves, basically what his honor said.
What's our standard of review on that ruling?
I think it's abuse of discretion, Your Honor. I guess because I've also asked for judgment NOV on that ground, it's just a footnote in Argument 5. I guess the court erred in not precluding plaintiff from presenting that claim because he should have had an expert under the D.C. versus Hampton case that I cited.
Erred as a matter of law because without expert testimony, there's no case.
Exactly, Your Honor.
So there is, as a matter of law, in every case of negligence supervision, there must be an expert. Is that what you...
No, Your Honor. I'm not saying that because I think the D.C. Versus Hampton case that I cited speaks to a special field of endeavor, and that is how social workers and social work agencies should supervise, for example, their foster parents. And in that case, the court held that an expert was needed to advance that claim. And that's the argument that I raised below in the Superior Court. And the judge thought that that was not the case and that this was something that the jury could figure out on its own. My argument was that the area of expertise that my client had, that is staffing these group homes and knowing how individuals with mental disabilities act and how folks who supervise them and work with them are trained, does require some expertise. So Mr. Summerson, plaintiff's expert, should have stated, or they should have had an expert to come forward and say, this is the kind of system you, as such an agency, need. And because you didn't have that type of situation in place, that mechanism.
But there's no set of facts which could go to a jury without an expert. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. Outside of this case, no, Your Honor. But based upon the law, Mr. Summerson was prevented from testifying about negligent hiring, which was actually a fairly large part of this case early on.
Well, let's assume Mr. Conyers took the plaintiff downtown and said, I'll be back in 5 hours. Go have fun, and I'll look for you around this area. Would an expert need to testify that is negligent supervision?
I don't know if that constitutes. I don't think so, Your Honor. This is something. I think that's a little bit different than the situation that we have in this case.
So it does depend on facts.
I think that for plaintiff to press a claim as they have, they need an expert to outline how my client breached a duty of care that was particular to it as a social agency, social work agency.
And Mr. Connors, you reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. That's where you are. You can continue, but you'll be using that time.
Your Honor, I think I'm just going to go forward at this point in time. Your Honor, it's my client's position that the jury verdict in this case was basically inconsistent. And you have apportionment of negligence that does not match up well at all with their apportionment as to recklessness and punitive damages. I just don't think the logical question is how can you be more reckless than negligent? I just think that's a fundamental question that requires a new trial in this instance. The other issue, Honor, is I think that
Delaware. Could the jury decide that there were more people, more agents of the corporation, collectively more reckless than Mr. Connors, and that therefore justifies a higher percentage?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I see no factual basis for a finding of greater negligence on the client's part. The active tortfeasor, criminal in this case, was Mr. Connors. As the Servino, I think it's the Servino case, states, my client is more like the Medical Center of Delaware. We're more a passive wrongdoer, so to speak. If you look at the, I invite Your Honor's attention to the Servino case because that talks about the not only the punitive damages claim. But it also talks about, that's what it talks about, Your Honor. I only have 4 seconds left, so. But I would ask Your Honors I invite Your Honors to look very critically at the punitive damages award.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Judge.
Good morning, members of the court. I'm Michael Bednash. I am the attorney for the appellees, Jeffrey Allen Jones, John Paul Jones, and Sue Ellen Jones, his parents. I will first address the argument of the judgment notwithstanding the verdict issue. As the court knows, the rule is that the evidence and all reasonable inferences must be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. In this case, there was testimony and evidence at trial that Jeffrey Rose, who was the number two person in charge at Delsed, he was Leonard Conyers' immediate supervisor. He knew that Leonard Conyers and Jeffrey Jones were together, going out together. He knew that they were going to hotels. This was the testimony of the investigating Newcastle County Police Detective Dominic Gregory. Despite that, Mr. Rose told the police officer that he felt it wasn't his responsibility to know what they were doing.
Excuse me, when did Mr. Rose know this?
It wasn't clear from the testimony.
It could have been toward the back end of the 18-month period.
It was sometimes during the 18-month period.
If that is the case, then what's the culpability? That is, if Mr. Rose didn't know until about the time that Ms. Olimbo found out.
Well, what makes me and the jury believe that it was earlier was that he said that he knew they were going to hotels, but he felt it wasn't his responsibility to look into it. So that implies that he knew it at an earlier time before the arrest of Mr. Conyers.
So if we use the wallet incident as the benchmark that got everything going, then you're saying the record would reflect that Mr. Rose knew they were going to hotels prior to the wallet being left in this one particular hotel.
Yes, Your Honor. And he said it wasn't his responsibility to know what they were doing. And that was the testimony of the police officer. So that, in and of itself, I believe, would defeat any motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict. There was clearly a dispute of fact. There were obviously many facts that were disputed. In fact, Mr. Rose, number two in charge, did not even know about Delsed's own sign-in, sign-out procedure. Jeffrey himself testified that that had to be done. Sally Alembo testified to that, as well as Jeffrey's parents.
Well, is there enough? Is that one statement by the police officer reporting, presumably, something that Mr. Rose told the police officer sufficient evidence for a jury to find that that for some reasonable period of time before the wallet incident, the company through Mr. Rose knew that there was something untoward going on?
In and of itself, perhaps, but that was just one of many.